Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to the Niler 9 podcast. Woo! It's 2024 and we're back with our first episode of this long-running podcast. How long have we been going now? This is episode 238. So long enough.
We'll leave it at that.
There's a lineage of
yeah. Thanks for listening. Bye, everyone.
Yeah, long. Too long. Bye. That's Andrea Cleary, of course, on the other line, as in noted musicologist.
I'm not a musicologist.
And PhD.
Not a musicologist. Thank you.
You are to me. You are to me.
Not a PhD either. PhD student. Hopefully soon to be candidate.
Oh, PhD God. Student.
You no, know,
you're
I'm
not a
PhD.
PhD yeah. But you are a PhD student. You're doing wonderful research things over there.
I'm trying.
Music. So, yeah. So as we record this, this is the night or the morning after our Listen Closely event in the Big Romance. So we saw each other last night for the Mad Villain listening party in the Big Romance, which was a lot of fun. Yeah, really great to hear that album in full on the Toby Hatchett speakers. Like, again, you mentioned it beforehand, like addressing the people who were there. It was like, it's weird, right? When you're sitting here listening to an album, but
yeah, there was something
really
about this one.
I really enjoyed listening to that, like, in that context.
Because it's a hip-hop album, because it's, you know, it's something you kind of want to dance to. This was definitely, like, even compared to the Fortet. So we've done Fortet, Rounds, we've done Sufjan Stevens, Illinois, and then we did Mad Villainy. And even compared to the Fortet one, there was a lot more kind of movement in the room. It was like people couldn't help but like kind of respond to the beats. It was really cool. Yeah, it was great. Shout out to my three students who came along as well. Nice to see you if you're listening to this. And yeah, it was a really, really lovely night. I really love doing those events. And we announced last night and we'll announce now that our next Listen Closely event for February will be us listening to Laurie Anderson's Big Science. Now, in the room last night, I asked, who here knows this album? And two people, a father and son, raised their hands and said, whoop, and everyone else didn't know the album. So if you want to come, buy tickets. But also, I do think that maybe the demographic didn't overlap with the Mad Villain fans. So, but if anyone's interested in,
I mean, I'll
in,
be honest, I'm not
Laurie Anderson or learning a bit more about her, my currently on hiatus podcast, My Favorite Album, I did a episode with Claire Beck, who chose that album as her favorite album, and she very much introduced me to that album and I love it now. So there's a nice kind of chat with me and her on that podcast about that album if you don't know much about it. And it really, really, really is fantastic. And I think it's going to sound just incredible on the speakers. So, you know, you and I were discussing, you're not that familiar with it except for Oh Superman. So maybe you'll just go in completely open.
Yeah, I'm thinking about it, like, I mean, what all I know about it is it's a seminal, important record. It's certainly, as we discussed as well, we wanted to platform more women.
Yeah, we've had three men in a row.
Series as well.
So it's time for some ladies.
That's true, yes. And funny enough, can I say this now? Because this is what you were thinking about doing. What you almost did for February. Now, you had a good idea. We were going to do a Joanna Newsom album, right? So I thought, great, we had Ease Down. I was like, cool, grand. It's like, do you want to do that? And then you were like, maybe we should do Have One On Me. And I was like, do you know that's like, over 2 hours
Andrea,
long?
That's two and that a half hours long. And I was like, oh yeah, okay. Maybe not that.
It could be. I mean, it could be an endurance test. All right.
We'd absolutely have to do breaks. But I mean, I'm not against it. Let us know. Write in if you'd come to a 2.5 hour listening party.
Something else that actually came up afterwards when I was talking to Dimitri from the Discord.
Hi, Dimitri.
And his pals. So from our Discord, which you get Patreon access, through Patreon you get access to, we were like, oh, maybe down in the line in December, we could do kind of like a spin the wheel kind of mystery album on the night, where you're like, you have 10 albums that we've chosen and somehow we do some sort of spin the wheel thing and be like, okay, which album
or
are we going to listen to
or
this
something
month?
Even.
That one.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Could be interesting. Could be, or maybe
or
not.
Tea, are you listening to our new game show idea?
Imagine that. Just a recording of people solemnly looking at their feet
for
46 minutes while a Mad
Babylon
plays.
Absolutely fabulous.
It's actually something that would be probably people would watch on YouTube. You know, like we've got mukbang already of people
I love
watching people eat. So
YouTube videos of people reacting to songs for the first time, I absolutely love. Like, I swear, like there's a few YouTubers who do like me reacting to like Beethoven's Fifth for the first time, and they're just like freaking out. And I'm like, I don't know if this is the first time you've heard this, but this is still a very entertaining format, so I will watch it. But there's one. There's this Canadian guy and his dad, and he plays albums for his dad, and they have a really nice little setup, a nice like LP player and good quality sound system and stuff. And his dad's really into music, so he's introducing him to like really cool like new albums, like Phoebe Bridgers' Punisher they did like a Kendrick Lamar or Lemonade by Beyonce, and his dad is just so like receptive to it. I can't remember the name of their channel, but I'll send it to you after and you can put it in the show notes. It's just really pleasant kind of watching, and you kind of see them connect with each other through like this kind of like cross-generational like interest in music. And then there's a few episodes where his dad introduces him to something that you might know as well. So sweet. It's nice. Yeah.
Great. Lovely. That's actually something that came up last night as well, and chatting to somebody, one of the artists that came last night, he was chatting to, and he was saying he was supposed to bring his dad, but his dad's car broke down or something. He brought his girlfriend, but he was like, yeah, me and my dad bought me the tickets for this. I was like,
so nice.
Wow, cool. Your dad bought you tickets for the Mad Villain listening party. That's cool. I'm into that. And then I had a conversation with him about like, and then others like Dimitri about just, you know, bringing your dad to gigs, and you're like going to gigs with your dad. And I was like, I brought my dad to see Queens of the Stone Age in the Ambassador, and he absolutely fucking loved it. It was so good.
Yeah.
That was back when I was in college a long time ago. But yeah, okay, so what are we going to talk about on this podcast? We want to kind of just ease ourselves back in. Normally we do a best of the month. We may talk about some of the music that we liked this month at the end of this podcast, but you know, there's been a lot happening. There's a lot happening in Irish music and also in the wider world of music journalism. Obviously, the big news this month is that Pitchfork was announced that it was going to be subsumed into GQ magazine. An announcement that kind of came out of nowhere for a lot of people, and certainly I think it was a surprise for the staff. I think at least 10 staff seem to be laid off, 10 to 12 staff who are working full-time on Pitchfork.com were let go. Condé Nast are the owners. They bought Pitchfork in 2015, so they run GQ and Vogue and The New Yorker, and they have decided to bring Pitchfork as a brand into the fold of GQ magazine. And it's been a while since there has been a internet music media flashpoint like this. The days when this was announced, you just saw so many people who were involved and giving their take on what was going on and reacting in real time to all this kind of stuff. it was really fascinating to see. And then you hearing stuff like, oh, Anna Wintour kept her sunglasses on while she let all these people go and all this kind of stuff. This is what you're dealing with. Where's the humanity of these people?
I know. It's well, all very know, I mean, Devil like, Wears Prada, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, isn't that film based on her?
Yes.
It is. So, yeah, I mean, I guess from one perspective, when Condé Nast bought Pitchfork in 2015, maybe it was no surprise that it was going to do something to it. On the other hand, as you were saying, it's a bit of a slap in the face to be bringing it into GQ, typically a
Gentleman's Quarterly
magazine. After Gentleman's Quarterly, after the last 5 years, which in terms of Pitchfork had done a lot of work in terms of expanding its coverage to be a lot more inclusive, and under the editor Pooja Patel, if you pay attention to Pitchfork, you wouldn't have noticed how much she has done in terms of bringing in more inclusivity and variation in voices. You know, Pitchfork started in the mid-90s in Chicago as this indie rock kind of irreverent music online music magazine, obviously became known for its big reviews and the scores and stuff like that. But in recent years, I think it had pivoted slightly to a bit more of, people use the word poptimist. Yes, it did cover Taylor Swift more often, but it also still, while it was covering Taylor Swift and everything and the National and whatever else, it was covering these really underground records that no one had ever heard of. And I think what's come out of the chat around this is that, first of all, there's a lot of artists who will suffer from this if it changes. Like, we don't know what the actual outcome's going to be in terms of ultimately, what does Pitchfork.com, where does it go? Does it actually disappear? Or does it become GQ, like Pitchfork.com just becomes a GQ Music or whatever? And interestingly, if you look at GQ Music, their existing coverage on the website is pretty dire. There's one about Turnstile making a sneaker playlist of songs. Michael Stipe reviews his 35 greatest jackets. You know, this is the kind of stuff that, like, it's style, it's lifestyle, it's moving in. Pitchfork obviously did a really good job in terms of features and stuff, and really going in depth on things. And that is something that is in danger of being missed now. I know I want to get your take on it, but I will say, I do think there's, my cynical view of it is that there was obviously a lot of talk about the Pitchfork union in advance of this. And the union wasn't getting what they wanted. And it seems to be a lot of the people who had joined the union were the ones that were let go. So I think that could factor into a lot of this, because Pitchfork, as it came out, is the most popular brand in terms of online stats of Condé Nast completely. So it's not like the website was failing and people weren't looking at it. That's an important point. It's not like, oh, well, Pitchfork isn't making money. I don't know if it was making money or not. It seems like it was. It seems like it was a very popular, influential brand that they're suddenly decided to can in some way. So what's your take on this?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many kind of different avenues you can look at it through. Obviously, my first reaction to it was the gender dynamics of it being folded into GQ, and just how disappointed I felt that, you know, I'm not saying I'm disappointed in Condé Nast for not making this giant company for not making a decision that, you know, doesn't feed their bottom line, but actually keeps a diverse sort of readership. But there really is something so disappointing about the decision to fold it into a men's magazine, because, like, I know we all know this, but, like, music serious music listening, we'll say, as a male pursuit is something that has existed within the music press, and specifically the rock press, since its inception. And it does feel, you know, you mentioned the advent of poptimism there, and the kind of the diversification of voices and of who's being covered on Pitchfork. Like, we all, everyone who works in music media has some kind of beef with Pitchfork, right? Like, it's, you know, they gave your favorite band a bad score, or there was a review that just kind of didn't really hit for you. Like, everyone kind of has an opinion about Pitchfork. Even a lot of people have a problem with the scoring system, but it's still an incredibly important thing to have a successful music website where people can read serious considerations about music, whether it's pop music, whether it's rock music, whatever it might be. And crucially, a website that will introduce you to new music and treat all music kind of seriously. And folding that into a men's magazine just sort of underscores this cultural assumption that serious music listening is for boys, and pop music or what pop stars are wearing, or, you know, that sort of like celebrity side of the music industry is for women. And those are the kinds of things that are covered in women's magazines. Like, there are no women's magazines really. I mean, Vogue do very good profiles of musicians from time to time, but there's no dedication to specifically catering to a music audience of women. So, but Pitchfork wasn't gendered. It hasn't felt gendered in a really long time. It has felt accessible to me. It's been a really long time since I've read a review or a piece on Pitchfork where I've thought that the gender politics of it were off or strange or a little bit sus. Like, their editorial team have been absolutely fantastic in diversifying their voices and the music that they cover, but also just sort of taking that out of the picture altogether. Like, it doesn't feel gendered. And folding it into GQ, we were talking about this last night, even if there isn't this idea of like music isn't for women, it's like, no, they, you know, women, we can obviously go onto the website and we can read it, but what magazines need to do with every single thing that they put out is to think about their readership. And the readership of GQ isn't women. The readership of GQ is men. So they're going to be thinking, what do our readership, i.e. men, between the ages of whatever, 25 and 40, whatever the readership of GQ is, what do men want to read about? What will men click on? And men will click on the top 10 Kanye West sneakers, or, you know, that kind of stuff. And there isn't going to be anything that... I don't even want to say caters to women, but like, there's going to be, we're not going to be a factor in it at all. So that was my first reaction, was that just kind of an anger and a disappointment that, like, you know, this behemoth of music journalism that has been a big part of my life as a music journalist, but as a music fan and as a listener for as long as I can remember, is, you know, kind of being taken away in a way, and kind of packaged up as a male pursuit again. And then the other issue, obviously, is seeing the reaction of staffers and editors and freelancers online, and just the kind of the precariousness of their position after the announcement. And we saw this with Bandcamp as well. Like, it seems to be that within arts publications across the board, not even just in music, this lack of consideration for writers as workers. And I think the union busting idea definitely holds some water, but this is across the board in the music industry. It is. And you and I are going to talk a little bit about our kind of very different experiences working in the music industry, but it has become almost impossible to make a living as a music journalist now. And to just see yet again groups of like incredibly talented people and incredibly hardworking people just hear these announcements, you know, and find out that they no longer have a job. It is so much more than just what's the future of music journalism going to be, which is an important conversation, but it's also like, what is the future of how we treat critics? Like, what is the role of the critic? Yeah. Like, why have we allowed corporations to swallow up all the space where critics can meaningfully make money doing a job, and then decide that actually that's not lucrative, or that doesn't fit in with their five-year plan, or whatever it might be? And then we're all just kind of thrown out to the wolves to start a Substack, or start a newsletter, or start a blog, or whatever it might be, and try to build this industry up again from the ground up. Like, it's this like weird cyclical thing, and it's so like when I stopped freelance music journalism, it was because I was starting a PhD. But, you know, a lot of the reason why I wanted to get out of it was because it was unsustainable for me. I couldn't do it anymore. And I had to diversify. I wrote book reviews. I wrote lifestyle kind of women's magazine stuff to kind of supplement the fact that I couldn't write about music all day. And I enjoy doing book reviews and women's lifestyle stuff. But it sort of underscores that, like, you cannot make a living doing this. Like, it is, or if you do, at any minute it could fold, you know. So,
well, that's what happens when you put your trust in a corporate in a body.
And we've no alternative. Like, that's the thing. It's like we have no alternative but to do that. There's no, like, it is so hard. Unless, like, you know, we were talking last night as well, like a lot of the people who've been let go from Pitchfork, an upside, a silver lining is that we're going to get loads of really good newsletters, like really good quality journalism from people.
Yeah.
They've already built up that profile through working with a corporation, you know? And so for people who are trying to get into it now, like, I don't know, like, it's...
Yeah, I hate to be that person who's like, well, I wouldn't bother. And I would never say that to anyone, because I think it's just... The conversation is, what does a music journalist look like now? And that whole idea of, you know, someone who goes to interview an artist for a feature or who reports on what's going on in the world is kind of gone in that way. I find it really interesting. You talked about those Substacks there. Yeah, I mean, that was one silver lining of all this. All of a sudden, I was discovering all these Substacks I'd never seen before. I was like, wow, these are all these been existing for a while now, doing some interesting stuff. And it makes me kind of reflect on what I do for 909 and how that works for the community and how it works for myself and how you can try and build these things. And it is such a difficult thing to answer because I've been doing this 20 years as of this year. Later in November, 20 years when I started this. So that's, well, it's almost 20 years. It's 19 years. It'll be 19 years. It'll be my 20th year starting. Mm. But you just kind of go, what is left? What is important? What do people want? Clearly, people wanted a nuanced conversation and interviews and features and discovery from Pitchfork. There was also Fact magazine folded as well recently, or it was announced that it was going to be completely going. Now, some of that Fact magazine, electronic music magazine, was kind of already announced to be on the way out, but it was still doing stuff. And their mix series, which had been going for years and years and years, was just quietly announced that would be shutting down. So yet another avenue. So it's like we've got stuff like Resident Advisor, and then we've got all of these little publications which are continuing. We've got the likes of Stereo Gum talking about music in Ireland. I like to think that myself is doing some of that stuff. But again, this is down to, like, what can you actually do and what do people want? It is really hard to dedicate your time to long form interviews or long form reviews when ultimately I found a lot of stuff in terms of typical album reviews, people probably don't want that anymore. And the algorithm doesn't want you to do that kind of stuff. We had a great, I didn't do it, but Droid, a guy from Dublin who used to run a website, used to DJ and now has a show on Dublin Digital Radio. He did an interview with Autechre with us recently, a big long form, like 15,000 word article, did it on with The Bug this week. Those kind of things he's doing that in his spare time. It's very hard to find time to do these kind of things. Yeah. But it makes me think about, like, what do people want? And there's been a lot of discourse about that as well, about the in-shitification of life in general. Is like the idea
I've been
that
thinking about that
everything's
term
got
a
worse.
Lot.
Yeah.
In-shitification of
everything's
the
got
internet.
Worse. Google search, like, results are shit.
Everything.
Everything is set up. If you think about, like, I always think about the SEO stuff. It's something that I spend a lot of time on with the website because I have to. I'm trying to work smart.
That's a search engine optimization for anyone who doesn't know.
So, good example of search engine optimization. If anyone's ever Googled a recipe review or a recipe for something, and you're like, why do I have to scroll through a table of contents, a 800 word, like, here's the, I just want to see what the ingredients and the method and the recipe actually is. But no, you have to scroll for ages. It's the way that Google prioritizes these things, which are actually make you more difficult for a human to read sometimes. And you're like, they say that that's not what they do, but it seems to be the truth. Because every time you look at it for a recipe, that's what you
find.
Can
I give you a tip for when that happens with recipes?
Yeah.
If you print the page, on your browser. If not like print it out, but if you do like print page,
oh yeah,
it gets rid of all the extra stuff and you can literally just scroll down to the ingredients, because a lot of it is like pictures and ads and all that stuff. But if you just go print web page, yeah, you'll be able to see it. So just a little tip. But yeah, right. But I mean, that is exactly it. It's the inshitification of things. And I mean, going back to the idea that people don't want to read album reviews, I mean, a big difference I noticed when I started early on, you know, writing about music, I was writing for blogs, I was writing for Head Stuff and Golden Plek and writing for free. There was no word count. You know, I could write as much as I wanted about something. I could write a 2,500 word review of an album, or I could write a 500 word review of an album. And I always leaned towards something a bit more long form, because that's the way that I like to write about music. But when I started writing for publications, and specifically kind of broadsheets and magazines therein and supplements therein, I really noticed, like, you know, I won't name any, right? But I was writing album reviews for one. And I think when I began writing album reviews for them, the word count was, there was at least one album a week that was given, I think, either 700 or 800 words. And that was the long album review. And the other album reviews were 400 words. And as time passed, that long quote unquote long form 700 to 800 word album review disappeared, and they all became 400 word album reviews. Now, anyone who's a writer, like we all know and understand what 400 words looks like and feels like, and what you can do in 400 words, and it's basically nothing. You can basically give a one sentence background of the band or artist. You can contextualize that this is their first, second, or third album. You can say where they're from. And you can talk about 2 to 3 songs and give your opinion on those songs. And you can write a quippy little summarizing sentence at the end. And that's it. There is no way to talk meaningfully. And what I find interesting about that is that sort of approach to album reviews, I think, is dated. I think it's the wrong decision, because we are still treating, or these publications are still treating, album reviews as though they are recommendations. And that's how and that's how it's always been. You know, the quote unquote golden age of rock journalism in the 1970s, you know, it was you read your favorite writer or critic or reviewer because you wanted to know what they were listening to. And if they recommended something to you, you would go out and you would spend your hard-earned money on a record, which was not cheap and which you wouldn't be able to listen to otherwise. Now, obviously, we have access to all music from all time periods, all the time, at the touch of a button on a little screen in our pockets. We don't need recommendations like that. What I think the role of the critic is now, and I mean, I was talking about this on a panel, in 2020, right before COVID-19, in 2020, about the role of the critic. And I was there as a music critic on Lyric FM. I was there as a music critic. There was a book critic, there was a film critic, and there was a food critic. And we were talking about the role of the critic. And I was saying that I think the role of the music critic now is to kind of translate or contextualize or give some kind of social or cultural context to the piece, so that when somebody goes and listens to something, they like it, they don't like it, whatever, they'll come to that piece, they'll read about it, and they will leave with something to think about. They will leave thinking about like the gender politics of it, or the racial politics of it, or thinking about how one genre is born out of this other genre, or the kind of the, you know, how location factors into this. And I believe that that is the role of the critic now. And I think that that's what we try to do when we talk about albums on this podcast as well, is to not only talk about like whether or not we like the music, but to also talk about like what it is signifying about our culture or about our society. And
yeah,
and I think Pitchfork and Bandcamp both allow critics to do this. Like, there's obviously Pitchfork have had a lot of purple prose over the years. You know, there really is only so many ways you can describe the sound of a guitar, and all rock critics will be familiar with the kind of feeling you have, where you're like, oh my God, how many different words can I think of to describe this sound? But I think what Pitchfork did, especially with poptimism, actually, it's to actually lend weight to the fact that popular music is an important part of our culture and is reflective of our culture, but also that, you know, rock music does the same, and dance music and hip hop. And these are the things that I think dedicated readers want to read. These aren't the things that are going to get you millions of clicks, but it will get you people returning. You kind of create a captive, dedicated audience. And I think that's what, you know, Condé Nast missed out on. That's what, when all of these magazines fold, it is because the focus is not on maintaining and tending to a dedicated readership. The focus becomes growth. And growth is not a good indicator of success in arts and culture necessarily. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. And I've thinking a lot about what, you know, on that point as well. An interesting one for me is that, so I stopped paying attention to, say, soccer for like 20 years or something until the pandemic, and I got back into like football again. So I got really into like the likes of the Second Captains and stuff, and listened to that kind of stuff every episode, every most of the episodes that come in. And it's just interesting to note how easy it is to create content around sport and, you know, to talk about what's happened on the field or off the field and business dealings and all this kind of stuff that happens around, where music is much more nebulous. It's more like, you know, there's this, the discovery part is something that I personally absolutely adore. I'm addicted to it still. I love discovering a song, whether it's been for just, you know, scrolling around, or something that comes on Spotify, something's on YouTube, somebody that recommends something to me, hearing a song in a mix, or like, that's what I do. I love this stuff. Every week I do 10 new songs to love this week. I do 10 Irish songs after. So I listen to what, like maybe nearly 150, 200 songs are, that are sent to me, and other stuff that's around that I've followed and all this kind of stuff from my sources. And I pick 10 and I pick 10. And I love doing that. I love it every week. But also I can acknowledge here that like that coverage is probably the least like trafficked on the site at the moment, because, and it has been for a longer time than, because that's what I started with. That's why I started Niall and I started doing that, to discover and share. And I think some of that is really still important. I don't, like, yes, people don't need 909 to discover music, but what they can maybe hopefully do is, like, I still do it. I still look at other sites and look at other sources for context and for discovery. I love that stuff. And most people maybe don't anymore. And they look for the news section, gigs, stuff like that, real life experiences. I think there's a lot, I've learned a lot from our Discord with the Patreon, where like community is really important, I think, as well. The idea that we're all going through this, we're experiencing this thing that's happening together, and we are talking about it en masse, and we're talking about it. That's pop culture. That's music culture. And that's sports culture as well. To come back to what I was saying about how addictive it can be to kind of like get back into following something like that.
Yeah.
Now, music obviously doesn't have that kind of narrative. It's not a competitive sport, but it does have, you know, stories of the day. And that's what a lot of what we're talking about here is, that kind of stuff.
I think it has a lot in common with sport, though, and especially football, especially how Irish people interact with like football and, you know, their teams in the United Kingdom, who we all follow, and like there's you know, there's a sense of community around your football team in a similar way that there's a sense of community around being a fan of Big Thief or a fan of MF Doom or whatever it is. Like, people are excited to hear the news, that people are excited to hear that there's a, you know, there's a big signing for Liverpool, but also there's, you know, Burial is going to release an EP next week. Like, there's I can see some kind of connections between how we deal with and handle sports, and how we deal with and handle music, as sort of indicators of ourselves and our identity, and how we kind of form our identities around, like, I think the things that we form our early identities around when we're children and when we're adolescents are kind of sports and music. And that's those are the two things that can very easily indicate to other people your interest, the kind of person you are, and the kind of person that you kind of want to be or want to be associated with. So if you're, you know, a Manchester United fan in the 90s, you love winning. Or if you, you know what I mean? Like, or
I just love you.
You know, like I'm not like super, I've also fallen out of following football because I just find it all very depressing these days. But like there's a lot of conversations about that. Like, and there's a kind of a tribalism.
Yeah.
And that tribalism exists in music as well, sure. I think.
But that tribalism is on a much wider scale in terms of sports and soccer in particular. Like if you look at Second Captains, they have 14,000 members on their Patreon. Mm. I know they are like an example, a shining example worldwide of what it is to create a media platform about something that you love. But I think it's really important to notice that, because if you look at, you know, I look at like Google Trends a lot just to see what's popular, and it's always like whatever match is on at the moment, like Marcus Rashford being in the Belfast nightclub in Laveries is really is funny to me at the moment, all that kind of stuff. Like our world's colliding there. I've been out in Laveries once, fair play to him. But you know, it just shows it's a wider scale. It's a different thing, I think. But music is really important in terms of, I think when we do these kind of events like last night and you have people on the Discord talking about the music love, you can see how much it means to them. Mm. You see how much like how important it is. And I think music is very regulating in terms of your mental health. Yeah. It's good for you to understand other people's perspectives, emotional capacity, emotional support. It's all of those things. It helps you understand the world. And it's whether you put a value on that is the other thing. And I think we're in this, I'm finding it really interesting at the moment. Somebody who's been doing this for nearly 20 years is like seeing what's happened, how the algorithms and platforms dictate what happens with music. So you look at TikTok and how, you know, what's trending in terms of music on TikTok becomes the big thing. You're looking at Instagram and how I keep seeing of these like videos on Instagram of like young, cool American kids taking videos where you're like, here are the five greatest songs that you've heard this week. And they're just like pointing at a Spotify link.
Yeah.
And you're like, is this what music journalism is now? You know what I mean? Like, it's kind of like, do I have to start doing that now? Because I'm not getting enough traction on Instagram with like, just like talking about the topics that I want to talk about. I have to make video all the time. I know it's been like, this is a conversation that's been 10 years old.
The pivot to video. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just I do value the written word still. Yeah. I still enjoy reading what people have to say. But I also enjoy, like, this is obviously we're saying this on a podcast now, but I do enjoy that. I love this chat, the nuance of chat about music in a more formal setting, about like what we do when we talk about music and we talk about what's happening. Mm. But also I do love a good written article as well.
Yeah.
And also it's there for life. It's there for you to, you don't have to it doesn't feel as like, it feels a little bit more passive than just like scrolling all the time to see, figure out what's going on. So I do think there's importance.
It's a shift
in terms of,
right, from music criticism as, you know, a branch of journalism to music recommendation as a kind of content. And those two things have a place in society and in our culture, but getting rid of one in favor of the other because the other gets in front of more people's eyes is, I think, a product of that sort of like growth mindset. You know, like you cannot put a value on somebody reading a really well-written, well-researched profile, for example. Like before our listening party last night, I read the New Yorker profile on MF Doom. And the writer spent like 3 days with him while he was recording the follow-up to Mad Villainy, which obviously never, 85% done, but never emerged. But he spent that time with Doom, and that's, you know, for people who are a fan of MF Doom, that's a nearly mythical kind of time. And we get this snapshot. He spends like 3 days with him. And there's something about, you know, reading these things in the New Yorker, obviously a Condé Nast publication, which is problematic, you know, that I'm using them as this, you know, bastion of great journalism while also criticizing them for their Pitchfork decision. But, you know, it's it's that time you can't put a value on the sort of the information that I gained from reading that, the context for Doom's work that I gained from reading that. And that spreads out. It's not just I'm learning something about Doom, but I'm learning something about a moment in hip hop history. And I'm learning something about this kind of this mythical man. And it makes me want to learn more. And it makes me want to read more about this person. And it piques my interest. And those sorts of emotions, that sort of curiosity that we all innately have about music, is something that is important, I think, to nurture. And it doesn't, you know, as individuals, I think it's important for us to keep our curiosity alive. It's very easy as we get older to become less curious. You know, I don't ever see it happening with you, but it does happen to people when they get older. They have children, or, you know, they have families and they've lives, and they don't have as much time to dedicate to music as something that feeds them and nurtures them, and as something that it is and should exist outside of boardrooms and looking at whether the graph is going up or the graph is going down. Like, music is so much more important than all of these things. And you really can't put a value on the experience that you have reading a really, really good piece of criticism or a really, really good profile. Because I think the other thing about music is that, like obviously you and I are big music people, music's our thing, right? But unlike sports, like there are people, and I know them, who if you ask them to name three Premier League teams, they'd just about be able to do it, right? Like or three basketball teams, whatever. But music is something that absolutely every single person in the world knows and experiences and has opinions or feelings about or associations with. Like, I was teaching recently and I was telling my students that music is a cultural universal, which is a word we use for something that is not only present in all cultures today, like no matter how remote, all cultures today, but evidence of it has existed in all cultures at all times in history. And it is the only real thing we have artistically. You know, other cultural universals are like language, like greeting one another, you know, like family structures, taboos. Like, it is that important and that ingrained in our humanity. And I know I'm getting kind of ooh-ooh about it, but if we treat music and music criticism, which is just a way of talking to one another about music, as something that has a bottom line and that we can actually take away from people, then we're not allowing those people to experience something that they should be able to experience, which is good, intelligent, well-researched, I nearly said the word content, criticism or journalism about music. And it's just like, it just makes me sad. Like, it just makes me sad that like it's a kind of a, it's becoming more of a minority thing to be able to, you know, talk about music meaningfully with one another. Like, that's sad.
Yeah. And I think, yeah, that's, I mean, there is that discourse as well about, like, especially breaking new artists when, and that is part of the problem with, you know, breaking new artists. It's where it becomes about your bottom line, your numbers, your things that you've done, your, you know, the followers, the streams, the monthly followers you have.
Your TikTok followers.
And all of that
followers.
Obscures, and obfuscates what's actually important is that, like, what that CMAT song makes you feel or what that Brian Eno track, how that makes you move through the world and how it helps you, or whatever, a Willie Nelson song and what it means to you and how it relates to you and your family, or you and your dad, whatever it is, you and your mother, you know, those kind of things, those kind of ideas, and how those things are so important for us all, and how that isn't counted in any bottom line, but it's more important than anything for a lot of people. So anyway, music is still important, guys. Don't forget it.
And I mean, you know, we're obviously like, we're preaching to the choir here. The listeners to this podcast, you know, are in the Discord. We're all chatting to one another about music every day. I learned so much from them. I get so many. I'm not a big discoverer of music these days just because of time, but any music that I'm discovering because of the Discord. So we're very much preaching to the choir of people who are interested in, we hope, intelligent conversation about music, who listen to us or who read your website and so on.
Yeah.
But it's, I think it's just this, I suppose we just wanted to sort of mark it as something that is that feels to us like, I don't want to say a shift, because it's been happening kind of incrementally over the past, like, probably longer than a decade, you know, the inshitification of the internet, you know, you mentioned, but the inshitification of criticism. And I'm sure people who are interested in film have noticed this in film criticism as well. There's not the kind of as much space for that as well. And, you know, I'm sure it's the same across the board in theatre and everything else. But I think it's just disappointing that, you know, the great Pitchfork, as much as problems as we've had with it over the years, is just has come down to a business decision made by Anna Wintour. And she has decided that this belongs in the men's magazine. And that's sort of what, like, triggered the conversation today. Like, it, you know, yeah, that's like, no, this we'll put this in the men's magazine, and that will be better for our bottom line. What about the cultural bottom line? What about the emotional bottom line, Anna? You know, take your sunglasses on, have some respect.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, look, that's all to say as well, to put a pin in it, support these independent platforms like ourselves who are doing these things day in, day out, who do not have a corporate overlord, and support the people you love.
Yeah.
And you like to listen to and you trust, because they can't really do it. Like, I can't do this without support of the people out there on Patreon. Mm-hmm. And like, the website runs through its reputation and advertising that we can bring on it. The advertising on the podcast is fairly limited in terms of what you get back. It's those people who engage with us directly and put advertisements on the website and engage with us in terms of sponsorship are giving us, allowing myself, and I say us, like, really allowing me to make a living from this and to continue to make a living from it. And sadly, there is not budget there for me bringing in other writers or anything like that. Mm. I don't have an investor. I don't have any of that kind of thing to do. So it's literally, this is a 95-99% maybe, you know, in terms of the daily is running.
Is you sitting at your computer while also trying to raise a baby.
This wouldn't exist. Yeah, this wouldn't exist without me just continuing to do it. If I gave up, you know, I used to have staff. I used to have people who were able to work. I wasn't able to pay them that well. And that's the thing. That's kind of like, it's just not possible to be able to do that anymore. Mm. And that's depressing as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, it is just the way it is. And I think that support is really important. So for me, if you don't do that already, it's patreon.com/909. That helps myself and it helps Andrea. Mm. But really, it's just about, you know, recognizing what you can do, doing what you can, and trying to give back. I try and do it with other people here and there. It's really difficult. I understand people don't have the money. Mm-hmm. It's grand. And that's what it is. But that's the way life works now. You're seeing so many artists as well. I mean, in terms of the money that they're making back through streaming and all that kind of stuff. Support them directly. Mm-hmm. Support anyone you can directly where you can tell that there's not going to be a cut taken off them, a massive cut. It's important. Yeah.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Well, we move on then to a couple of other things that have happened recently. Yes. Let's talk about the Choice Music Prize.
Yeah.
We may actually get one of those round tables going on this to discuss these albums in full, maybe in February,
that'd be good,
before it all arrives. But the 10 albums that were nominated for Irish Album of the Year this year, any surprises here for you? I'm going to read them out briefly. Green Chatten, Chaos for the Fly, C-Mat, Crazy Mad for Me, John Francis Flynn, Look Over the Wall, See the Sky, Kojak, Phantom of the Afters, Lancome, False Lancome, Rachel Lavelle, Big Dreams, Soda Blonde, Dream Big, The Murder Capital, Gigi's Recovery, The Scratch, Mind Yourself, and Ezra Williams, Supernumeraries. So that's a solid 10 albums that were released in the last year that have been nominated for the Irish Album of the Year. Probably the award that we end up discussing a lot on this podcast, because music is dear to our hearts, and Irish music in particular. A very solid list. You'd have to say that probably Lancome's False Lancome would be the favorite there. I would say that
Lancome and C-Mat both have a kind of an equal shot. If you're doing the odds up, I would put them quite close together. The only ones I haven't listened to are the Green Chattin and the Ezra Williams ones, so I can't speak to either of those. Though I will say Green Chattin was a little bit of a surprise for me that he made the shortlist, but you know, I haven't listened to it, so I can't comment on it.
I don't think it's bad. I think it's nice. It's a nice album, but I kind of do feel like it's maybe more the Fontaines influence that has brought him here, because I think there are better albums that were released from Irish artists this year.
Yeah,
I was a little bit surprised to see that there. C-Mat, obviously she won it last year. Crazy Mad for Me is a really good album as well, but I think they say that it shouldn't influence, you know, who won before, but I think it does a little bit.
I think, yeah, so, I mean, it must do, right? Even if you're trying not to.
Well, it does in your decision. It's not like, yeah, I mean, you're supposed to take the album on its own merits. When you're in there and you're doing the judging stuff, you're supposed to be like, it doesn't matter if they've won it before, you have to discard that. But I think a part of you is like, well, if they won it last year, do they really need to win it again this year? Probably not. Like, John Francis Flynn, second great record that he's released now. Kojak, his third album or second album, fully probably not.
Kojak hasn't won.
You know, Incendiary. No, he hasn't won.
I think Kojak and Rachel Lavelle would be like, if I think like C-Mat and Lancome would be kind of, for me, either of those would be the expected win. But Kojak and Rachel Lavelle, I think, would be good decisions. They're both excellent albums. I'd love to see Rachel Lavelle do it. I think she's primed for it, and I think that winning Irish Album of the Year would be.
Record.
I mean, it feels appropriate. It does feel like a new sound. She is a very, very exciting Irish artist, and I think that she's primed to, you know, do great things elsewhere as well. Yes, I wouldn't be surprised if she did it either. And then, yeah, I mean, so that Soda Blonde album was really good well, and
Soda Blonde
Scratch was good, Murder Couple, I'm not mad on Murder Couple though, but I can kind of appreciate
a better album than their first one.
It was a step up, but it wasn't the best album. It wasn't the best Irish album of the year, I don't think. No. But I support their inclusion in the list, I think. But it's an interesting. Do you have there who's been confirmed to perform on the night?
Yeah, John Francis Flynn, Kojak, Lancome, Rachel Lavelle, The Murder Capital, Soda Blonde, Ezra Williams. This is going to happen on March 7th in Vicker Street every year, the Choice Music Prize. The winners announced, and 7 of the 10 will be performing. The Scratch are only able to perform on the night, and C-Mat and Green Chattin have yet to confirm their attendance.
It is the same night as the Smile in the Three Arena, so a lot of people have a lot of big decisions to make, including me. I really love that new Smile album, and I am considering for the first time in many years not going to the Choice and going to see the Smile in the Three Arena, but we'll see what happens.
Sure, listen.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting one. The judges list is up there for anyone to see. Representatives from District, 2FM, Cord Blossom, RTE, of course, who are involved majorly in the award itself. BBC Radio Ulster, Other Voices, 8 Radio. It'll be interesting to see what wins. I think, that Lancome album, False Lancome, had huge international cultural and critical cachet in the end of year lists.
And nominated for a Brit as nominated for a Brit Award as well, weren't they? Weren't they nominated at the Brits?
No, I don't think
what were they nominated
at? Oh, you're talking about the Mercury.
Sorry, the Mercury.
The Mercury, yeah. C-Mat was nominated for the Brit
Awards.
That's
it, yeah. Best International Artist, yeah.
And Jazzy, who's also one of some of these other award lists, which is the kind of stuff which is Irish Breakthrough Artists of the Year and Irish Artists of the Year. I think I was involved in that last year when the Fontaines won the Irish Artist of the Year and Keane Ducrow won Irish Breakthrough Artist of the Year. There is no criteria on any of this stuff. So it's kind of a bit more open. Irish Breakthrough Artist of the Year, 4-9 in Maine, Jazzy, John Francis Finn, Oxen, who are basically a supergroup involving Lancome and Katie Kim and Percolator. It's Scratch in there as well. It'll be interesting to see what wins that. But I think the album one is the one that really matters.
Yeah.
And it's the one that is really important. Again, it's always like any year when I'm like, it's definitely going to be Lancome, you're just like, it's the rug is going to be pulled from under.
Yeah.
You just know.
Yeah, I can't call this, to be honest. I think it is a strong list. Like there's one or two that I kind of that I might not have there, but I think it's overall a strong list, and it could be any one of four for me.
Yeah.
Those being C-Matt, Lancome, Rachel Lavelle, and probably Kojak or John Francis Finn, maybe. Any one of five. Yeah. But yeah, so that's a choice. Yeah. We look forward to it.
That's a choice. So I wanted to just briefly talk about the Eurovision this year as well, because I think there's a lot going on there. First of all, in terms of the act that was chosen to go forward to represent Ireland out of the six, it was an interesting one this year. The acts that were on the kind of late Eurovision Song Contest, Euro Song Special, were kind of like acts that we featured before on Another Nine. So we had the likes of Erica Cody, Ailsa, JLOL, and Toshin Bambi Thug, who was the eventual winner. And I have to say, I was surprised by Bambi Thug getting over the line there in terms of the win. Have you heard the song?
Maybe, will I?
I'd be interested to see what you think of it, because I was like, that's really out there. And it's kind of like, how would you describe it? It's like weird. Bambi Thug makes kind of weird, hyper pop, electronic, kind of fun, odd music. And I was like, I just can't see anyone going for that this year. But it has won and it is going. And I think what's really interesting here is that ultimately, there was a lot of discourse this year, and there should be. It's growing at the moment. I think we're going to be talking about Eurovision again, because Israel are in the Eurovision, and there's a lot of talk around Europe at the moment about whether they should be allowed to be even in this. And this is not a new conversation.
No.
Obviously, it's buoyed by Israel's genocidal acts in Gaza in the last 100 plus days. Why is a country who is doing that allowed to exist in this entertainment competition? 26,000 people have died in Gaza as a result of Israel's actions, and they've been accused of war crimes and accused of genocide in the International Court of Justice. And there's increasing, evidence that they are committing these kind of crimes.
So, and the Eurovision themselves, they say that it's not a political entity. They don't take politics into things. But obviously, people are pointing out the fact that after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, Russia were banned from partaking in the Eurovision as well. So they're like, whether we like it or not, I mean, the idea that we could talk about the Eurovision and say that it is apolitical is completely ridiculous. Anybody who is a Eurovision fan will know, even, you know, about like the voting blocks and the like how countries vote for one another based on kind of historical allegiances. It's a really, really, really political competition, and to pretend that it isn't, just so that you can include Israel, or so that you can justify the inclusion of Israel while Russia is banned, is in itself obviously a political act. So I mean, I think I'll be joining the boycott of it. I mean, I'm not I wish all the best to the Irish artists going, but I think for me, the Eurovision, it doesn't mean as much to me as it does to other people. It is quite easy for me to not pay attention to it and to not look at it and to not engage with it. And I think it would just kind of make me feel a bit icky on the night if you know, when it's just particularly now, it's, yeah,
well,
I don't know.
What was interesting, I think, for me, both Bambi Thug and Erica Cody in advance at an RT press conference on the morning of the Eurosong last week did say that they think that Israel shouldn't be allowed entry.
Yeah, and I think that these kinds of comments and conversations are really, really important. Even if Israel are not banned from it, even if Israel do partake in it, which it looks like they will, it is very, very important that our acts who we are sending. And I mean absolutely no ill will to like any country or any artist who was involved with this. Like absolutely nobody is, no individual person is responsible for kind of boycotting on an individual level. And we know that individual boycotts don't work anyway. But it's important that we enjoy and exercise the freedom to criticize this decision as artists and as fans of the Eurovision. So it'll be interesting to see. I mean, there's a lot of countries talking about a boycott. Ireland, there's a conversation about a boycott from Ireland as well. So
absolutely, I mean, yeah. And there has been. To be seen. And this is not a new idea. Like I said, in 2019, there was actually my partner was involved in a kind of anti-Israeli, pro-Palestine solidarity alternative Eurovision mm-hmm. that took place in the National Stadium that year because it took place in Israel.
Yeah.
So this year it takes place in Malmo in Sweden. Mm-hmm. And yeah, there are 1,000 artists from Sweden, including Robin Fever Ray, have signed a petition to say that Israel's inclusion trivializes violations of international law and makes the suffering of the victims invisible. And I think this isn't something that's going to go away either, because it is a issue that we can, people who are seeing the injustices happening in the world and how the Western powers are complicit in what's going on mm-hmm. in Gaza and the horrible nature of what's happening there, and, you know, things that used to have some sort of red line decency are no longer seem to be there in terms of, because Israel is emboldened by its support from Western powers. So I think this isn't something that's going to go away.
No.
Iceland as well, Finland as well. Artists from both of those countries have been talking about this. So, you know, I think it is a difficult situation for an artist who is going there. And I think Bambi Thug, who is representing Ireland, has also kind of said, you know, it's not, I mean, I don't think, what did they say exactly? I think that when Russia was made leave competition, there should be the same rules for everyone, but it's also not down to contestants. It's down to the Eurovision.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I think this isn't going to go away.
No.
This isn't like maybe an artist will be making statement around it on stage. There, you know, it's, I think if Israel is allowed to continue to be included in the Eurovision, this isn't something that's,
I would imagine, if there is a statement or a flag or something made on stage, that I would not be surprised if that meant a disqualification for the artist. Genuinely, like,
I'd be interested to see what happens,
because they do not allow political statements on the stage. But I think, particularly with Palestine, I think it's a particularly volatile space to be making any kind of statement about Palestine, and it would not surprise me if it meant exclusion from the competition. Doesn't mean I don't want to see it. Doesn't mean I don't think it would be cool if someone did make a statement, but wouldn't surprise me if they were like, no, you're disqualified. But, you know.
Yeah. But anyway, I just think it's interesting because that will be, I think that criticism is only going to go louder before May arrives, and unless Israel is taken out of that competition. And I think that's what probably should happen ultimately.
Yep.
Can't see it happening. But anyway, by ignoring that, I think it's just going to get louder and louder and louder. So those are the main things that have been happening in January while we took a break. It's February, we're back with the new music stuff. I guess we will be back to regular programming as of next week, whatever that may be. But in the meantime, Andrea, what is there anything you've been listening to or anything you want to recommend or shout out in terms of what's consuming you?
Yeah, I think, you know, past month, I think has been a really good month for Irish music. I really like the new albums from Sprints and from New Dad as well. Both of those are really cool albums. Really nice to have like two solid Irish albums in the first month of the year. I mentioned The Smile as well. That's kind of all the new music I've been listening to, haven't gotten around to a lot. Television, obviously, like everybody else, I've been watching The Traitors. I've been watching...
Can we have a Traitors
yes,
chat?
Please.
Can we
do it? Let's do it, come on.
Because you talked about it before last year and I didn't get into it.
No.
Now I'm fully in it. And I've watched it all, obviously.
Yeah.
It's over last week. Season two.
Best thing on television.
I enjoyed this so much.
It's honestly like...
I couldn't believe how much I enjoyed it. I was like...
Claudia Winkleman. Like, can we have a moment for that woman? The woman she is. Like, she... No one is having more fun at work than Claudia Winkleman in The Traitors.
Yeah,
no one's better dressed.
She's having fun.
No one is like the... it's so campy. It's so, you know, like the funeral episode with one of the contestants, like walking to her own grave, like, Paul couldn't be my son, but Ross is, like, just iconic, like, just absolutely iconic, like, Diane, like, Paul, like, oh, it was, I think season one was, like, or season two was even better than season one, I think, like, season one was really fun because you got to see people learn how to play the game, and we got our first villain in Wilf, and Wilf is, like, you know, he'll always be iconic for being the first traitor to kind of make you realize that traitors can turn on one another. And then you see the game grow in the second season because they've learned a bit from the first season and they've got different tactics. And it's just so good. Like, if anyone hasn't watched it, like, there's no one that I wouldn't recommend it to. I'd recommend it to an 80-year-old and I'd recommend it to a 13-year-old. Like, there's no demographic that I don't think would be absolutely delighted by this show. Like, it's for everyone. Everyone.
And the final was perfect. I thought this time, like, it was so good the way it was. Spoiler alert, if you haven't watched the trailer, just skip
do not listen to this next bit because it will ruin it.
Yeah, but I was so delighted for Harry the way he actually won it, because and it was perfect because, like, you couldn't have written it better. Molly, his best friend, down to those two, and she makes a decision. It's like, everyone is like, my dad was texting me, he was like, why did Molly not realize what Jazz was doing?
The name on the slate, she had written Jazz, and then she looked over at Harry and said, is it you? And Harry looked her in the eyes with his gorgeous little calf eyes and said, it's not me. And she rubbed out she rubbed out Harry's name and wrote Jazz's name. And, like, oh my God.
She clearly panicked because, like, why would Jazz want to vote again if he was a traitor? He was going to win.
I know. It's pure panic. It's like, upsetting. And no one was thinking about the shield question. No one was thinking, wait a minute. Everybody who knew that Harry had a shield is now gone. So the only logical thing that it could have been is that Harry had the shield and was a traitor and set up the whole shield thing. Like, my Harry was, like, yelling about this. He was like, how are they not thinking about the shield? Like, it was just, it's just, like, it's so good. It really is so good. And, like, I play Mafia or Werewolf with my friends. Like, we go away for a weekend once a year, and a big part of that weekend is playing Werewolf. And it's our favorite kind of, like, parlor game, and we spend a whole evening doing it, and we love those kinds of games. And yeah, it's just so fun to see it, like, in a television format, and it not feeling like it's sucked the fun out of it. It's actually added so much to it. And yeah, it's absolutely brilliant. It's brilliant. It's like, it was like when they got Paul out, like, it was,
he was such a pantomime villain. It was so great. He thought he was the shit.
I wanted Paul to win. Funny. I 100% wanted him to do it. And then when Harry usurped him, like, it was,
he was great. Oh. He was great at being a traitor. He was having great fun. Doing it.
Like, I mean, it's so funny.
Andrea,
like,
what would you be like if you were a traitor? What would you be like? Would you be able to do it?
Right. So obviously, I've thought about this so much. Right. So I know going into the show that I would prefer to be a traitor. I'm always rooting for the traitors. I think they have more to do. I think you can go in as a faithful and not actually do anything. You can kind of just skate by if you just don't get in the way of the traitors. The traitors are the ones that deserve the money because they're the ones with the sleepless nights. They're, like, you know, dealing with like, you know, different personalities in front of different people and playing 4D chess, and it's incredible. But I think I'd be a good traitor because I think, if I do say so myself, I have quite a trustworthy face. I think people on the street ask me for directions, or they ask me, do I know, you know what I mean? I think I'm relatively approachable. And I just think I'd be a good traitor. And I think part of the reason why I think I'd be a good traitor is because if you have anxiety or you have any kind of mental health issues that kind of make you mask a little bit in front of people, or, you know, regulate your behavior around people, then you're already pretty practiced at doing it. And I was thinking as well, like, queer people who who have to like, or who have in the past been closeted or had to like pass in some way, there's kind of this practices that a lot of different communities do in terms of like passing and behaving in a certain way so as not to seem like something else. And I feel, as a person with anxiety and as a queer person, I've got a little bit of practice of those things. So it's, yeah, I think it's interesting.
Interesting.
Yeah. I don't know. I'd love to read like a really long like paper about like the psychology of picking whether to be a traitor. And the reason as well why I'd like to be a traitor is because I think I'd be a fucking useless faithful. I'm very gullible. So I'd have to go in as a traitor, otherwise I wouldn't have a chance. Do you know? What about you? Would you want to be a traitor or a faithful?
I just feel like I would give myself up at some point without trying to, like, I just would. I would just be like, I think that's the hardest part, is like it's not saying something random where people are like, what are you saying that for? Like, I don't know. It was a bit like watching, I wouldn't be as bad as your man. Oh, what was his name? Not Ross.
Your man who had that absolute meltdown for no.
The brain fart where he was like, can someone just tell, can I just ask the room, can someone tell me why I'm not a traitor? Why they think I'm not a traitor? It was like Zach, that was so random.
It was like the moment in season one where the guy is like, I'm a magician and she's my girlfriend. And you're like, what are you doing? Yeah. Sit down.
That makes no sense.
Sit down.
But I love that part. Actually, do you know, I'd give it a good go for sure.
As a traitor.
I think I'd enjoy the devilment of it all.
Yeah. And, I want to be in those clothes. You know,
I think I'd be pretty good. What I have been noticing is like the way that people like introduce, and maybe it's just the way it's shot sometimes, but the way that they kind of like, no, I'm trying to like introduce this idea. It's like, I think Irish people, I'm looking forward to the Irish version because I think more casual. Yeah, there's an Irish version on the way.
Who's hosting it?
Absolutely. I don't know yet. I don't know.
I'm scared. I'm scared.
You've got the ick.
I just think like maybe just get Irish people on the UK one. Let us have Claudia. Like, maybe. I'm scared about who's going to host it. But anyway,
we'll see. We'll see what happens. Yeah. Get a decent castle somewhere in the Midlands.
We've got beautiful castles.
Or down in Galway. We do have plenty of those.
Plenty of them.
So yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting. It'll be interesting. You'll watch it. You'll definitely watch it.
Oh, I'll watch it.
Have you seen any of the other ones?
No.
You can recommend now.
No interest. I know the American one.
I heard the Australian one was good.
I've heard the Australian one is good. I know the American one for their first season or I'm not sure how many seasons there's been, but their early seasons were a mixture of celebrities and muggles, but their new series is just celebrities.
Yeah, the reality TV celebrity stuff. I'm like,
nah. I don't like that. Because the thing that's so amazing about the traitors is that they are normal people, and it's so rare that you get like people who just look like people on television. You know, obviously there's like Love Island and all of these kinds of shows where everyone sort of looks like a different version of the same thing. It's really nice to just see like a diverse set of normal looking human beings on the telly. Louise Bruton writes really well in her newsletter about the kind of representation of various disabilities in The Traitors as well, and that it is like really leading the way, and it doesn't affect any kind of way of like participating in the game. And it's not like people's disabilities aren't built up as something that they are overcoming to play this game. It's just like, no, here's a normal person who happens to have a certain kind of disability. And you just forget about it. And you're just like, okay, like, yeah, look at all these normal people sitting around just going in and accusing each other of murder. Like, it's just, it's great. It's brilliant. Yeah. So
delicious.
So The Traitors has been like a big, big part of my January. But other than that,
since we had a child, I've been watching a lot more TV because you spend a lot more time just sitting around.
Yeah.
But and it's been great. Traitors has been great for that.
Yeah.
Definitely. That and Fargo and Dope Sick. And Reservation Dogs. If you've not,
I haven't seen Reservation Dogs. I watched Dope Sick when it came out. It's excellent.
Yeah, I'm still watching that now. I'm
really
loving the new season of Fargo as well.
I've only seen episode one of Fargo, and it was so much fun and so entertaining, and I absolutely love it. I do not like the new season of True Detective. I think...
Yeah, you're saying that. I'm interested. I thought it was set up to be like, oh, it's a return to form, as if people had seen it already.
No.
But you're...
It's
you're
weird,
like,
right? Because like Nick Palazzo, who was the creator of the show and wrote seasons, I think seasons 1, 2, and 3, he has been like an absolute asshole online about the new season. Like, he updated his bio in, I think, his Twitter account to be like, creator of True Detective, and then put in brackets, not the new season, or not season 4, or whatever it is. And he's just been saying like all this shitty stuff about it online. But also, before it came out, a lot of the fans of True Detective, particularly True Detective season 1, did not like that this was a show that was being led by women and women of color, and, you know, a tale as old as time. There was, you know, review bombings of it before it even came out. People were giving it like, you know, really low scores on Rotten Tomatoes and various aggregate sites. So then when the critics actually got their hands on the show itself, I think they were given the first 4 or 5 episodes. There was a lot of like extremely positive reviews about it. And I don't doubt that these people liked the show, but I do think that there was maybe a bit of an overstatement of like its good qualities in a lot of those reviews. That's the only way I can describe it or can understand it, because I have genuinely found it like baffling in terms of like who, like what are people's relationships to one another? Why should I care about this person? Like, what can we talk about the murder? Like, I like that there's kind of ghosts and supernatural elements, but like there's not nearly enough of them. We're just not spending enough time talking about the murder, and it doesn't feel like a show that's about a murder investigation. It feels like a show that's about kind of like interpersonal conflict and nothing else. And it's just, I don't know. Yeah. I don't like it. I think, okay, I'm giving up on it.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. Well, I may end up watching it once I finish Fargo.
You might like it, you know, like it's
one.
I think it's just me. Yeah. It's, I just don't think it's well done or well written, and, you know, yeah. Harry says about it, he's like, it would want to cop itself on. He's willing to give it one more episode, so I'll probably do that. But
okay, yeah. Other than that, watch Anatomy of a Fall last week, which
so
I very much
good.
Enjoyed. That's
so
very, very good.
That's the best film I've seen in ages.
It's really good, isn't it?
So good.
It's about what, it's not about what you think it's going to be about. And then it's about, yeah, I love the dynamic of it all and how it all works. And that song, oh, banger.
Yeah. So, and I think no matter what the genre or the plot, I think that all films should take place in a courtroom. Like, that's just something about me is I love a courtroom. I love a lengthy courtroom.
What is the story with the French justice system, though? You can just
fucking
say whatever the fuck
mad.
You want.
Because I was thinking about
this woman
them.
Is a bisexual.
I know.
It's fine.
But they're all talking to each other across the courtroom, and they can interject with questions for whoever they want. And I was thinking about, because the only other experience I have, like knowing anything about the French justice system, is obviously the Ian Bailey trial that happened in absentia of him. I was like, this is a mad old system. Everyone's just chatting to each other. Very interesting. Learned a lot about it. I wouldn't want to be on the stand in France. No. I'll tell you that much. I don't blame him not going.
Yeah. So I actually heard about this film through my own search or like the Google search results coming to the website, because I wrote about that Pimp cover in 2016, and all of a sudden I was getting linked to that. I was like, what's going on? Why are people linking to this post from 2016? So the band are called Bacow Rhythm and Steel Band.
Banger.
And they do a lot of this kind of steel drum steel band covers of things, and I love a steel band cover. So what I actually did, I shared a playlist on Patreon last week of steel band kind of covers, and then like just some Jamie XX in there as well, because he's always using the steel pan. There's some famous like well-known songs that use it, like Heaven Is and Hell Is on Earth by 20th Century Steel Band. They do a lovely cover of Love Sick, the Muramasa Aesop Rocky tune. Blood Orange is in there. There's even a Radiohead track. There's Fever Ray, all that kind of stuff. A fun thing to do. But yeah,
banger.
Every time the song came on, which came on a lot in this film, I was like, wow.
Yeah. And also,
I'd like,
can we talk about best performance from a dog in supporting role. My God. Like, oh my what God. A dog. Yeah, yeah. Unbelievable dog. I hope he gets to go to the Oscars, like that little one from The Artist. Put a little bow on him. Yeah. Absolutely gorgeous. What was his name? Great. His name is Snoop. That was it. Snoop Dogg. Got everyone. The child that was in it was just like marvelous. And your man, the French actor that was in it, I've never seen him in anything before, but he was just like incredible. And then obviously she's like scene stealing, incredible. Harry seen her, I can't remember her name now. Harry seen her in other films. And she's brilliant. She's brilliant in everything that she's in. So I'll have to go and have a look. But yeah, it's nominated for Best International Picture at the Oscars, I believe.
It is indeed. All right, well, I didn't get the chance to talk about any of the albums that I've been enjoying or anything like that. We did briefly have a discussion last night about that. We're both like the new Dad album quite a lot. Marika Hackman is an album I'm really enjoying at the moment.
Haven't got around to it yet.
Those two in particular, Sprint's album is doing really well in terms of Irish releases. Really, a lot of people seem to be taken by the kind of post-punk garage rock kind of buzz. They've been doing really well. Released that album first week in January. I love some of the stuff on it a lot more than others, but really think it's a really solid album if you're looking for that kind of post-rock, post-punk stuff. The New Dad, I'm mostly impressed with because I think they are a new young band, and I think there's a confidence there which comes from the production as well. Chris Ryan on production as well, I think it's really well.
I'm just so excited about them. Just really excited about
it's still
New
early
Dad.
Days for them, really.
And Sprints as well. I'm really excited about Sprints as well. Like
there's a lot going on. The other thing I'm really looking forward to this year is, and I've been listening to a lot this month, is a band called English Teacher. Terrible name. But I did see them in May last year at The Great Escape, and they were brilliant. And I really like everything they've done since then. So English Teacher, they're playing here May 22nd as well in Whelan's and Ulster Sports Club Belfast on May 21st. Really good band. So Albert Road is the last track they had out. They have a song called The World's Biggest Paving Slab, which has just been constantly, I put that on quite a lot. So English Teacher, a takeaway recommendation for you there. But we leave it there. That's an hour and a half now. We've been discussing music this month. So lots more to get back into. We'll be back next week, I presume. And we will have more to chat about then. Andrea, thanks so much.
Thank you, Nat.
Nice to flex the podcast muscle again.
Happy St. Bridget's Day to everybody. Happy Imbolc.
Happy St. Bridget's Day. Enjoy your long bank holiday weekend, wherever you are and whatever you're doing, whether you're in Ireland or not.
Be safe, be seen.
Enjoy yourself. Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Emil. Talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye.
Confidence starts with loving who you are. And when your skin feels nourished and glows on the outside, you naturally radiate confidence from the inside. Give your skin a glow up with Osea's clinically proven Mega Moisture Duo. This ultra-hydrating body care features two of Osea's best sellers, Undaria Algae Body Oil and Undaria Collagen Body Lotion. These seaweed-powered heroes use skincare-level ingredients normally reserved for your face for results you can see and confidence you can feel. Osea has been making clean, clinically proven seaweed-infused face and body care products for over 28 years. This luxurious skincare is vegan, cruelty-free, and climate-neutral certified, so you never have to choose between your values and your best skin. Glow from the inside out. Get 10% off your first order with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. That's OSEAMalibu.com, code GLOW.